and on the few occasions when it did, with oil or gold, never in such numbers. Yet here were magnificent tombs, avenue upon avenue of them, built in all manner of styles from the classical to the baroque, and marked, though he was not certain his fatigued senses were telling him the truth, with motifs from warring theologies. It was beyond him. He needed sleep. The tombs had been standing a century or more. The puzzle would still be there at dawn. He found himself abed out of sight between two graves and lay his head down. The spring growth of grass smelled sweet. He'd slept on far worse pillows, and would again. Chapter 5. A Different Ape. The sound of an animal woke him, its growls finding their way into floating dreams and calling him down to earth. He opened his eyes and sat up. He couldn't see the dog, but he heard it still. Was it behind him? The proximity of the tombs threw echoes back and forth. Very slowly he turned to look over his shoulder. The darkness was deep, but did not quite conceal a large beast, its species impossible to read. There was no misinterpreting the threat from its throat, however. It didn't like his scrutiny, to judge by the tenor of its growls. "Hey, boy," he said softly. "It's okay." Ligaments creaking, he started to stand up, knowing that if he stayed on the ground, the animal had easy access to his throat. His limbs had stiffened lying on the cold ground. He moved like a geriatric. Perhaps it was this that kept the animal from attacking, for it simply watched him, the crescents of the whites of its eyes, the only detail he could make out, widening as its gaze followed him into a standing position. Once on his feet, he turned to face the creature, which began to move toward him. There was something in its advance that made him think it was wounded. He could hear it dragging one of its limbs behind it, its head low, its stride ragged. He had words of comfort on his lips when an arm hooked about his neck, taking breath and words away.
"Move, and I gut you."
With the threat, a second arm slid around his body, the fingers digging into his belly with such force, he had no doubt the man would make the threat good with his bare hand. Boone took a shallow breath. Even that minor motion brought a tightening of the death grip at neck and abdomen. He felt blood run down his belly and into his jeans.
"Who the fuck are you?" the voice demanded.
"My name's Boone. I came to find Midian."
Did the hold on his belly relax a little when he named his purpose?
"Why?"
a second voice now demanded. It took Boone no more than a heartbeat to realize that the voice had come from the shadows ahead of him, where the wounded beast stood. Indeed, from the beast.
"My friend asked you a question," said the voice at his ear. "Answer him."
Boone, disoriented by the attack, fixed his gaze again on whatever occupied the shadows and found himself doubting his eyes. The head of his questioner was not solid. It seemed almost to be inhaling its redundant features, their substance darkening and flowing through socket and nostrils and mouth back into itself. All thought of his jeopardy disappeared. What seized him now was elation. Narcissus had not lied. Here was the transforming truth of that. "I came to be among you," he said, answering the miracle's question. "I came because I belong here." A question emerged from the soft laughter behind him.
"What does he look like, Pelequin?"
The thing had drunk its beast face down. There were human features beneath, set on a body more reptile than mammal. That limb he dragged behind him was a tail, his wounded lope the gait of a low-slung lizard. That, too, was under review as the tremor of change moved down its jutting spine.
"He looks like a natural," Pelequin replied. "Not that that means much."
Why could his attacker not see for himself, Boone wondered. He glanced down at the hand on his belly. It had six fingers, tipped not with nails but with claws, now buried half an inch in his muscle.
"Don't kill me," he said. "I've come a long way to be here."
"Hear that, Jackie?" said Peliquin, thrusting from the ground with his four legs to stand upright in front of Boone.
His eyes, now level with Boone's, were bright blue. His breath was as hot as the blast from an open furnace.
"What kind of beast are you, then?" Boone wanted to know.
The transformation was all but finished. The man beneath the monster was nothing remarkable, 40, lean, and sallow-skinned.
"We should take him below," said Jackie. "Lylesburg will want to see him."
"Probably," said Peliquin. "But I think we'd be wasting his time. This is a natural, Jackie. I can smell him."
"I've spilled blood," Boone murmured. "Killed 11 people." The blue eyes perused him. There was humor in them.
"I don't think so," Peliquin said.
"It's not up to us," Jackie put in. "You can't judge him."
"I've got eyes in my head, haven't I?" said Peliquin. "I know a clean man when I see one."
He wagged his finger at Boone.
"You're not Nightbreed," he said. "You're meat. That's what you are. Meat for the beast."
The humor drained from his expression as he spoke, and hunger replaced it.
"We can't do this," the other creature protested.
"Who'll know?" said Peliquin. "Who'll ever know?"
"We're breaking the law."
Peliquin seemed indifferent to that. He bared his teeth, dark smoke oozing from the gaps and rising up over his face. Boone knew what was coming next. The man was breathing out what he'd moments ago inhaled, his lizard self. The proportions of his head were already altering subtly, as though his skull were dismantling and reorganizing beneath the hood of his flesh.
"You can't kill me," he said. "I belong with you."
Was there a denial out of the smoke in front of him? If so, it was lost in translation. There was to be no further debate. The beast intended to eat him. He felt a sharp pain in his belly and glanced down to see the clawed hand detach itself from his flesh. The hold at his neck slipped, and the creature behind him said,
"Go."
He needed no persuasion. Before Peliquin could complete his reconstruction, Boone slid from Jackie's embrace and ran. Any sense of direction he might have had was forfeited in the desperation of the moment, a desperation fueled by a roar of fury from the hungry beast, and the sound, almost instant, it seemed, of pursuit. The necropolis was a maze. He ran blindly, ducking right and left wherever an opening offered itself, but he didn't need to look over his shoulder to know that the devourer was closing on him. He heard its accusation in his head as he ran. "You're not Nightbreed. You're meat. Meat for the beast." The words were an agony more profound than the ache in his legs or his lungs. Even here, among the monsters of Midian, he did not belong. And if not here, where? He was running, as prey had always run when the hungry were on its heels, but it was a race he couldn't win. He stopped. He turned. Peliquin was 5 or 6 yards behind him, his body still human, naked and vulnerable, but the head entirely bestial, the mouth wide and ringed with teeth like thorns. He too stopped running, perhaps expecting Boone to draw a weapon. When none was forthcoming, he raised his arms toward his victim. Behind him, Jackie stumbled into view, and Boone had his first glimpse of the man. Or was it men? There were two faces on his lumpen head, the features of both utterly distorted, eyes dislodged so they looked everywhere but ahead, mouths collided into a single gash, noses slits without bones. It was the face of a freak show fetus. Jackie tried one last appeal, but Peliquin's outstretched arms were already transforming from fingertip to elbow, their delicacy giving way to formidable power. Before the muscle was fixed, he came at Boone, leaping to bring his victim down. Boone fell before him. It was too late now to regret his passivity. He felt the claws tear at his jacket to bare the good flesh of his chest. Pelequin raised his head and grinned, an expression this mouth was not made for. Then he bit. The teeth were not long, but many. They hurt less than Boone had expected, until Pelequin pulled back, tearing away a mouthful of muscle, taking skin and nipple with it. The pain shocked Boone from resignation. He began to thrash beneath Pelequin's weight, but the beast spat the morsel from its maw and came back for better, exhaling the smell of blood in its prey's face. There was reason for the exhalation. On its next breath, it would suck Boone's heart and lungs from his chest. He cried out for help, and it came. Before the fatal breath could be drawn, Jackie seized hold of Pelequin and dragged him from his sustenance. Boone felt the weight of the creature lifted, and through the blur of agony saw his champion wrestling with Pelequin, their thrashing limbs intertwined. He didn't wait to cheer the victor. Pressing his palm to the wound on his chest, he got to his feet. There was no safety for him here. Pelequin was surely not the only occupant with a taste for human meat. He could feel others watching him as he staggered through the necropolis, waiting for him to falter and fall so they could take him with impunity. Yet his system, traumatized as it was, didn't fail. There was a vigor in his muscles he'd not felt since he'd done violence to himself, a thought that repulsed him now as it had never before. Even the wound throbbing beneath his hand had its life and was celebrating it. The pain had gone, replaced not by numbness, but by a sensitivity that was almost erotic, tempting Boone to reach into his chest and stroke his heart. Entertained by such nonsenses, he let instinct guide his feet, and it brought him to the double gates. The latch defeated his blood-slicked hands, so he climbed, scaling the gates with an ease that brought laughter to his throat. Then he was off, up toward Midian, running not for fear of pursuit, but for the pleasure his limbs took in movement and his senses in speed. Chapter 6. Feet of Clay. The town was indeed empty, as he'd known it must be. Though the houses had seemed in good shape at half a mile's distance, closer scrutiny showed them to be much the worse for being left unoccupied for the cycle of seasons. Though the feeling of well-being still suffused him, he feared that loss of blood would undo him in time. He needed something to bind his wound, however primitive. In search of a length of curtaining or a piece of forsaken bed linen, he opened the door of one of the houses and plunged into the darkness within. He hadn't been aware until he was inside how strangely attenuated his senses had become. His eyes pierced the gloom readily, discovering the pitiful debris the sometime tenants had left behind. All dusted by the dry earth, years of prairie had borne in through the broken window and the ill-fitting door. There was cloth to be found, a length of damp, stained linen that he tore between teeth and right hand into strips while keeping his left upon the wound. He was in that process when he heard the creak of boards on the stoop. He let the bandaging drop from his teeth. The door stood open. On the threshold, a silhouetted man, whose name Boone knew, though the face was all darkness. It was Decker's cologne he smelled, Decker's heartbeat he heard, Decker's sweat he tasted on the air between them. "So," said the doctor, "here you are." There were forces mustering in the starlit street. With ears preternaturally sharp, Boone caught the sound of nervous whispers, of wind passed by churning bowels, and of weapons cocked ready to bring the lunatic down should he try to slip them. "How did you find me?" he said. "Narcisse, was it?" Decker said. "Your friend at the hospital?" "Is he dead?" "I'm afraid so." "He died fighting." Decker took a step into the house. "You're hurt," he said. "What did you do to yourself?" Something prevented Boone from replying. Was it that the mysteries of Midian were so bizarre he'd not be believed, or that their nature was not Decker's business? Not the latter, surely. Decker's commitment to comprehending the monstrous could not be in doubt. Who better than to share the revelation with? Yet he hesitated. "Tell me," Decker said again, "how did you get the wound?" "Later," said Boone. "There'll be no later. I think you know that." "I'll survive," Boone said. "This isn't as bad as it looks. At least it doesn't feel bad." "I don't mean the wound. I mean the police. They're waiting for you." "I know. And you're not going to come quietly, are you?" Boone was no longer sure. Decker's voice reminded him so much of being safe, he almost believed it would be possible again if the doctor wanted to make it so. But there was no talk of safety from Decker now, only of death. "You're a multiple murderer, Boone. Desperate, dangerous. It was tough persuading them to let me near you." "I'm glad you did." "I'm glad, too," Decker replied. "I wanted a chance to say goodbye." "Why does it have to be this way?" "You know why." He didn't, not really. What he did know more and more certainly was that Peliquin had told the truth. "You're not Nightbreed," he'd said. Nor was he. He was innocent. "I killed nobody," he murmured. "I know that," Decker replied. "That's why I couldn't remember any of the rooms. I was never there." "But you remember now," Decker said. "Only because..." Boone stopped and stared at the man in the charcoal suit. "Because you showed me." "Taught you," Decker corrected him. Boone kept staring, waiting for an explanation that wasn't the one in his head. It couldn't be Decker. Decker was reason. Decker was calm. "There are 2 children dead in Westlock tonight," the doctor was saying. "They're blaming you." "I've never been to Westlock," Boone protested. "But I have," Decker replied. "I made sure they saw the pictures, the men out there. Child murderers are the worst. It'd be better you died here than be turned over to them." "You?" Boone said. "You did it?" "Yes. All of them. And more." "Why?" Decker pondered on this a moment. "Because I like it," he said flatly. He still looked so sane in his well-cut suit. Even his face, which Boone could see clearly now, bore no visible clue to the lunacy beneath. Who would have doubted, seeing the bloodied man and the clean, which was the lunatic and which his healer? But appearances deceived. It was only the monster, the child of Midian, who actually altered its flesh to parade its true self. The rest hid behind their calm and plotted the deaths of children. Decker drew a gun from inside his jacket. "They armed me," he said, "in case you lost control." His hand trembled, but at such a distance he could scarcely miss. In moments it would be over. The bullet would fly and he'd be dead, with so many mysteries unsolved. The wound, Midian, Decker. There was no other moment but now. Flinging the cloth he still held at Decker, he threw himself aside behind it. Decker fired, the shot filling the room with sound and light. By the time the cloth hit the floor, Boone was at the door. As he came within a yard of it, the gun's light flashed again, and an instant after, the sound. And with the sound, a blow to Boone's back that threw him forward, out through the door and onto the stoop. Decker's shout came with him. "He's armed!" Boone heard the shadows prepare to bring him down. He raised his arms in sign of surrender, opened his mouth to protest his innocence. The men gathered behind their cars saw only his bloodied hands, guilt enough. They fired. Boone heard the bullets coming his way, 2 from the left, 3 from the right, and 1 from straight ahead aimed at his heart. He had time to wonder at how slow they were and how musical. Then they struck him. Upper thigh, groin, spleen, shoulder, cheek, and heart. He stood upright for several seconds. Then somebody fired again, and nervous trigger fingers unleashed a second volley. 2 of these shots went wide, the rest hit home. Abdomen, knee, two to the chest, one to the temple. This time he fell. As he hit the ground, he felt the wound Pelequin had given him convulse like a second heart, its presence curiously comforting in his dwindling moments. Somewhere nearby, he heard Decker's voice and his footsteps approaching as he emerged from the house to peruse the body. "Got the bastard," somebody said. "You sure he's dead?"
"He's dead," Decker said.
"No, I'm not," Boone thought. Then thought no more. Part 2. Death's a Bitch. The Miraculous Two is born, has its season, and dies. Carmel Sands, Orthodoxies. Chapter 7. Rough Roads. 1. Knowing Boone was gone from her was bad enough, but what came after was so much worse. First, of course, there'd been that telephone call. She'd met Philip Decker only once and didn't recognize his voice until he identified himself. "I've got some bad news, I'm afraid."
"You found Boone?"
"Yes."
"He's hurt?"
There was a pause. She knew before the silence was broken what came next. "I'm afraid he's dead, Laurie." There it was. The news she'd half known was coming, because she'd been too happy and it couldn't last. Boone had changed her life beyond all recognition. His death would do the same. She thanked the doctor for the kindness of telling her himself, rather than leaving the duty to the police. Then she put the phone down and waited to believe it. There were those among her peers who said she'd never have been courted by a man like Boone if he'd been sane, meaning not that his illness made him choose blindly, but that a face like his, which inspired such fawning in those susceptible to faces, would have been in the company of like beauty had the mind behind it not been unbalanced. These remarks bit deep, because in her heart of hearts she thought them true. Boone had little by way of possessions, but his face was his glory, demanding a devotion to its study that embarrassed and discomfited him. It gave him no pleasure to be stared at. Indeed, Laurie had more than once feared he'd scar himself in the hope of spoiling whatever drew attention to him, an urge rehearsed in his total lack of interest in his appearance. She'd known him to go days without showering, weeks without shaving, half a year without a haircut. It did little to dissuade the devotees. He haunted them because he in his turn was haunted. Simple as that. She didn't waste time trying to persuade her friends of the fact. Indeed, she kept conversation about him to the minimum, particularly when talk turned to sex. She'd slept with Boone 3 times only, each occasion a disaster. She knew what the gossips would make of that. But his tender, eager way with her suggested his overtures were more than dutiful. He simply couldn't carry them through, which fact made him rage and fall into such depression she'd come to hold herself back, cooling their exchanges so as not to invite further failure. She dreamt of him often, though. Scenarios that were unequivocally sexual. No symbolism here, just she and Boone in bare rooms, fucking. Sometimes there were people beating on the doors to get in and see, but they never did. He belonged to her completely, in all his beauty and his wretchedness. But only in dreams. Now more than ever, only in dreams. Their story together was over. There'd be no more dark days when his conversation was a circle of defeat. No moments of sudden sunshine because she'd chanced upon some phrase that gave him hope. She'd not been unprepared for an abrupt end, but nothing like this. No Boone unmasked as a killer and shot down in a town she'd never heard of. This was the wrong ending. But bad as it was, there was worse to follow. After the telephone call, there'd been the inevitable questioning by the police. Had she ever suspected him of criminal activities? Had he ever been violent in his dealings with her? She told them 1,000 times he'd never touched her except in love, and then only with coaxing. They seemed to find an unspoken confirmation in her account of his tentativeness, exchanging knowing looks as she made a blushing account of their lovemaking. When they'd finished with their questions, they asked her if she would identify the body. She agreed to the duty. Though she'd been warned it would be unpleasant, she wanted a goodbye. But Boone's body had disappeared. At first, nobody would tell her why the identification process was being delayed. She was fobbed off with excuses that didn't quite ring true. Finally, however, they had no option but to tell her the truth. The corpse, which had been left in the police mortuary overnight, had simply vanished. Nobody knew how it had been stolen. The mortuary had been locked up, and there was no sign of forced entry, or indeed why. A search was underway, but to judge by the harassed faces that delivered this news, there didn't seem to be much hope held out of finding the body snatchers. The inquest on Aaron Boone would have to proceed without a corpse. 2. That he might never be laid to rest tormented her. The thought of his body as some pervert's plaything, or worse, some terrible icon, haunted her night and day. Her power to imagine what uses his poor flesh might be put to shocked her. Her mind's downward spiral of morbidity made her fearful, for the first time in her life, of her own mental processes. Boone had been a mystery in life, his affliction a miracle that gave her a sense of herself she never had. Now, in death, that mystery deepened. It seemed she'd not known him at all, even in those moments of traumatic lucidity between them, when he'd been ready to break his skull open and she'd coaxed the distress from him. Even then, he'd been hiding a secret life of murder from her. It scarcely seemed possible. When she pictured him now, making idiot faces at her or weeping in her lap, the thought that she'd never known him properly was like a physical hurt. Somehow she had to heal that hurt, or be prepared to bear the wound of his betrayal forever. She had to know why his other life had taken him off to the back of beyond. Maybe the best solution was to go looking where he'd been found, in Midian. Perhaps there she'd find the mystery answered. The police had instructed her not to leave Calgary until after the inquest, but she was a creature of impulse. She'd woken at 3 in the morning with the idea of going to Midian. She was packing by 5, and an hour after dawn, heading north on Highway 2. 3. Things went well at first. It was good to be away from the office, where she'd be missed, but what the hell, and the apartment, with all its reminders of her time with Boone. She wasn't quite driving blind, but damn near it. No map marked any town called Midian. She'd heard mention of other towns, however, in exchanges between the police. Sheerneck was one she remembered, and that was marked on the maps. She made that her target. She knew little or nothing about the landscape she was crossing. Her family had come from Toronto, the civilized East, as her mother had called it, to the day she died, resenting her husband for the move that had taken them into the hinterland. The prejudice had rubbed off. The sight of wheat fields stretching as far as the eye could see had never done much for Laurie's imagination, and nothing she saw as she drove changed her mind. The grain was being left to grow, its planters and reapers about other business. The sheer monotony of it wearied her more than she'd anticipated. She broke her journey at McLennan, an hour's drive short of Peace River, and slept a full night undisturbed on a motel bed, to be up and off again good and early the next morning. She'd make Sheerneck by noon, she estimated. Things didn't quite work out that way, however. Somewhere east of Peace River, she lost her bearings and had to drive 40 miles in what she suspected was the wrong direction till she found a gas station and someone to help her on her way. There were twin boys playing with plastic armies in the dirt of the station office step. Their father, whose blonde hair they shared, ground a cigarette out among the battalions and crossed to the car.
"What can I get you?"
"Gas, please, and some information."
"It'll cost you," he said, not smiling.
"I'm looking for a town called Sheerneck. Do you know it?"
The war games had escalated behind him. He turned on the children.
"Will you shut up?" he said.
The boys fell silent until he turned back to Laurie.
Too many years of working outdoors in the summer sun had aged him prematurely.
"What do you want Sheer Neck for?" he said.
"I'm trying to track somebody."
"That's so," he replied, plainly intrigued.
He offered her a grin designed for better teeth.
"Anyone I know," he said. "We don't get too many strangers through here."
There was no harm in asking, she supposed. She reached back into the car and fetched a photograph from her bag. "You didn't ever see this man, I suppose?"
Armageddon was looming at the step. Before looking at Boone's photograph, he turned on the children.
"I told you to shut the fuck up," he said,
then turned back to study the picture. His response was immediate.
"You know who this guy is?"
Lori hesitated. The raw face before her was scowling. It was too late to claim ignorance, however. "Yes," she said, trying not to sound offensive. "I know who it is."
"And you know what he did?" The man's lip curled as he spoke. "There were pictures of him. I saw them."
Again, he turned on the children.
"Will you shut up?"
"It wasn't me,"
one of the pair protested.
"I don't give a fuck who it was," came the reply.
He moved toward them, arm raised. They were out from his shadow in seconds, forsaking the armies in fear of him. His rage at the children and his disgust at the picture were welded into one revulsion now.
"A fucking animal," he said, turning to Lori. "That's what he was. A fucking animal."
He thrust the tainted photograph back at her.
"Damn good thing they took him out. What do you want to do? Go bless the spot?"
She claimed the photograph from his oily fingers without replying, but he read her expression well enough. Unbowed, he continued his tirade.
"Man like that should be put down like a dog, lady, like a fucking dog."
She retreated before his vehemence, her hands trembling so much she could barely open the car door.
"Don't you want no gas?" he suddenly said.
"Go to hell," she replied. He looked bewildered.
"What's your problem?" he spat back.
She turned on the ignition, muttering a prayer that the car would not play dead. She was in luck. Driving away at speed, she glanced in her mirror to see the man shouting after her through the dust she'd kicked up. She didn't know where his anger had come from, but she knew where it would go, to the children. No use to fret about it. The world was full of brutal fathers and tyrannical mothers, and come to that, cruel and uncaring children. It was the way of things. She couldn't police the species. Relief at her escape kept any other response at bay for 10 minutes, but then it ran out, and a trembling overtook her, so violent she had to stop at the first sign of civilization and find somewhere to calm herself down. There was a small diner among the dozen or so stores, where she ordered coffee and a sugar fix of pie, then retired to the restroom to splash some cold water on her flushed cheeks. Solitude was the only cue her tears needed. Staring at her blotchy, agitated features in the cracked mirror, she began to sob so deeply nothing, not even the entrance of another customer, could shame her into stopping. The newcomer didn't do as Lori would have done in such circumstances and withdraw. Instead, catching Lori's eye in the mirror, she said,
"What is it, man or money?"
Lori wiped the tears away with her fingers. "I'm sorry," she said. "When I cry," the girl said, putting a comb through her henna hair, "it's only over men or money."
"Oh."
The girl's unabashed curiosity helped hold fresh tears at bay.
"A man," Lori said.
"Leave you, did he?"
"Not exactly."
"Jesus," said the girl. "Did he come back? That's even worse."
The remark earned a tiny smile from Lori.
"It's usually the ones you don't want, right?" the girl went on. "You tell them to piss off, they just keep coming back like dogs."
Mention of dogs reminded Lori of the scene at the garage, and she felt tears mustering again.
"Oh, shut up, Cheryl," the newcomer chided herself. "You're making it worse."
"No," said Lori. "No, really. I need to talk."
Cheryl smiled. Cheryl Margaret Clark was her name, and she could have coaxed gossip from angels. By their second hour of conversation and their fifth coffee, Lori had told her the whole story, from her first meeting with Boone to the moment she and Cheryl had exchanged looks in the mirror. Cheryl herself had a story to tell, more comedy than tragedy, about her lover's passion for cars and hers for his brother, which had ended in hard words and parting.
She was on the move to clear her head. "I've not done this since I was a kid," she said. "Just going where the fancy takes me. I've forgotten how good it feels. Maybe we could go on together, to Sheerneck. I've always wanted to..." "I've forgotten how good it feels. Maybe we could go on together, to Sheerneck. But is this good a destination place, Annie? All is that right? Is being eaten to the fancy free?" "No, but is this good a destination, is Annie? All directions being equal to the fancy free."
Chapter 8. Where He Fell. So they traveled on together. They had taken directions from the owner of the diner, who claimed he had a better than vague idea of Midian's whereabouts. The instructions were good. Their route took them through Sheerneck, which was bigger than Laurie had expected, and on down an unmarked road that in theory led to Midian. "Why do you want to go there?" the diner owner had wanted to know. "Nobody goes there anymore. It's empty." "I'm writing an article on the gold rush," Cheryl had replied, an enthusiastic liar. "She's sightseeing." "Some sight," came the response. The remark had been made ironically, but it was truer than its speaker had known. It was late afternoon, the light golden on the gravel road, when the town came into view. And until they were in the streets themselves, they were certain this could not be the right place, because what ghost town ever looked so welcoming? Once out of the sun, however, that impression changed. There was something forlornly romantic about the deserted houses, but finally the sight was dispiriting and not a little eerie. Seeing the place, Laurie's first thought was, why would Boone come here? Her second, he didn't come of his own volition. He was chased. It was an accident that he was here at all. They parked the car in the middle of the main street, which, give or take an alleyway, was the only street. "No need to lock it," Cheryl said. "Ain't anybody coming to steal it." Now that they were here, Laurie was gladder than ever of Cheryl's company. Her verve and good humor were an affront to this somber place. They kept whatever haunted it at bay. Ghosts could be laid with laughter. Misery was made of sterner stuff. It was so easy to imagine Boone here, alone and confused, knowing his pursuers were closing on him. It was easier still to find the place where they'd shot him down. The holes the stray bullets had made were ringed with chalk marks. Smears and splashes of blood had soaked into the planks of the porch. She stood off from the spot for several minutes, unable to approach it, yet equally unable to retreat. Cheryl had tactfully taken herself off exploring. There was nobody to break the hypnotic hold the sight of his deathbed had upon her. She would miss him forever. Yet there were no tears. Perhaps she'd sobbed them out back in the diner restroom. What she felt instead, fueling her loss, was the mystery of how a man she'd known and loved, or loved and thought she'd known, could have died here for crimes she'd never have suspected him of. Perhaps it was the anger she felt toward him that prevented tears, knowing that despite his professions of love, he'd hidden so much from her, and was now beyond the reach of her demands for explanation. Could he not at least have left a sign? She found herself staring at the bloodstains, wondering if eyes more acute than hers might have found some meaning in them. If prophecies could be read from the dregs in a coffee cup, surely the last mark Boone had made on the world carried some significance. But she was no interpreter. The signs were just more of many unsolved mysteries, chief among them the feeling she voiced aloud as she stared at the stairs. "I still love you, Boone." Now there was a puzzle, that despite her anger and her bewilderment, she'd have traded the life that was left in her just to have him walk out through that door now and embrace her. But there was no reply to her declaration, no wraith breath against her cheek, no sigh against her inner ear. If Boone was still here in some phantom form, he was mute and breathless, not released by death, but its prisoner. Somebody spoke her name. She looked up. "Don't you think?" Cheryl was saying. "I'm sorry?" "Time we went," Cheryl repeated. "Don't you think it's time we went?" "Oh." "You don't mind me saying," You look like shit. Thanks. Lori put her hand out in need of steadying. Cheryl grasped it. You've seen all you need to, honey, she said.
Yes. Let it go.
You know, it still doesn't seem quite real, Lori said.
Even standing here, even seeing the place, I can't quite believe it. How can he be so irretrievable? There should be some way we could reach, don't you think, some way to reach and touch them?
Who?
The dead. Otherwise it's all nonsense, isn't it? It's all sadistic nonsense.
She broke her hold with Cheryl, put her hand to her brow, and rubbed it with her fingertips.
I'm sorry, she said. I'm not making much sense, am I?
Honestly, no. Lori proffered an apologetic look. Listen, Cheryl said. The old town's not what it used to be. I think we should get out of here and leave it to fall apart. What do you say?
I'd vote for that.
I keep thinking, Cheryl stopped.
What?
I just don't like the company very much, she said. I don't mean you, she added hurriedly.
Who then?
All these dead folk, she said.
What dead folk?
Over the hill? There's a bloody cemetery.
Really?
It's not ideal viewing in your state of mind, Cheryl said hurriedly, but she could tell by the expression on Lori's face she shouldn't have volunteered the information. You don't want to see, she said. Really you don't.
Just a minute or two, Lori said.
If we stay much longer, we'll be driving back in the dark.
I'll never come here again.
Oh, sure. You should see the sights. Great sights. Dead people's houses. Lori made a small smile.
I'll be quick, she said, starting down the street in the direction of the cemetery.
Cheryl hesitated. She'd left her sweater in the car and was getting chilly. But all the time she'd been here, she hadn't been able to dislodge the suspicion that they were being watched. With dusk close, she didn't want to be alone in the street.
Wait for me, she said, and caught up with Lori, who was already in sight of the graveyard wall.
Why is it so big? Lori wondered aloud.
Lord knows. Maybe they all died out at once.
So many. It's just a little town.
True.
And look at the size of the tombs.
I should be impressed.
Did you go in?
No, and I don't much want to.
Just a little way.
Where have I heard that before?
There was no reply from Lori. She was at the cemetery gates now, reaching through the ironwork to operate the latch. She succeeded. Pushing one of the gates open far enough to slip through, she entered. Reluctantly, Cheryl followed.
Why so many? Lori said again.
It wasn't simply curiosity that had her voice the question. It was that this strange spectacle made her wonder again if Boone had simply been cornered here by accident, or whether Midian had been his destination. Was somebody buried here he'd come hoping to find alive, or at whose grave he'd wanted to confess his crimes? Though it was all conjecture, the avenues of tombs seemed to offer some faint hope of comprehension the blood he'd shed would not have supplied had she studied it till the sky fell.
It's late, Cheryl reminded her.
Yes, and I'm cold.
Are you?
I'd like to go, Lori.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, of course. It's getting too dark to see much anyhow.
You noticed? They started back up the hill toward the town, Cheryl setting the pace. What little light remained was almost gone by the time they reached the outskirts of the town. Letting Cheryl march on to the car, Lori stopped to take one final look at the cemetery. From this vantage point, it resembled a fortress. Perhaps the high walls kept animals out, though it seemed an unnecessary precaution. The dead were surely secure beneath their memorial stones. More likely, the walls were the mourners' way to keep the dead from having power over them. Within those gates, the ground was sacred to the departed, tended in their name. Outside, the world belonged to the living, who had nothing left to learn from those they'd lost. She was not so arrogant. There was much she wanted to say to the dead tonight, and much to hear. That was the pity of it. She returned to the car, oddly exhilarated. It was only once the doors were locked and the engine running that Cheryl said,
"There's been somebody watching us."
"You sure?"
"I swear. I saw him just as I got to the car."
She was rubbing her breasts vigorously.
Jesus, my nipples get numb when I'm cold.
What did he look like? Laurie said.
Cheryl shrugged.
Too dark to see, she said.
Doesn't matter now. Like you said, we won't be coming back here again.
True, Laurie thought. They could drive away down a straight road and never look back. Maybe the deceased citizens of Midian envied them that.
Chapter 9. Touched. 1. It wasn't difficult to choose their accommodation in Sheer Neck. There were only two places available, and one was already full to brimming with buyers and sellers for a farm machinery sale that had just taken place, some of the spillage occupying the rooms at the other establishment, the Sweetgrass Inn. Had it not been for Cheryl's way with a smile, they might have been turned away from there, too, but after some debate, a twin-bedded room was found that they could share. It was plain but comfortable.
"You know what my mother used to tell me," said Cheryl, as she unpacked her toiletries in the bathroom.
"What?"
"She used to say, 'There's a man out there for you, Cheryl. He's walking around with your name on.' Mind you, this is from a woman who'd been looking for her particular man for 30 years and never found him. But she was always stuck on this romantic notion. You know, the man of your dreams is just around the next corner. And she stuck me on it, too, damn her."
"Still?"
"Oh, yeah, I'm still looking. You'd think I'd know better after what I've been through. You want a shower first?"
"No, you go ahead."
A party had started up in the next room, the walls too thin to muffle much of the noise. While Cheryl took her shower, Laurie lay on the bed and turned the events of the day over in her head. The exercise didn't last long. The next thing she knew, she was being stirred from sleep by Cheryl, who'd showered and was ready for a night on the town.
"You coming?" she wanted to know.
"I'm too tired," Laurie said. "You go have a good time."
"If there's a good time to be had," said Cheryl ruefully.
"You'll find it," Laurie said.
"Give 'em something to talk about."
Cheryl promised she would and left Laurie to rest, but the edge had been taken off her fatigue. She could do no more than doze, and even that was interrupted at intervals by loud bursts of drunken hilarity from the adjacent room. She got up to go in search of a soda machine and ice, returning with her calorie-free nightcap to a less than peaceful bed. She'd take a leisurely bath, she decided, until drink or fatigue quieted the neighbors. Immersed to her neck in hot water, she felt her muscles unknotting, and by the time she emerged, she felt a good deal mellower. The bathroom had no fan, so both the mirrors had steamed up. She was grateful for their discretion. The catalogue of her frailties was quite long enough without another round of self-scrutiny to swell it. Her neck was too thick, her face too thin, her eyes too large, her nose too small. In essence, she was one excess upon another, and any attempt on her part to undo the damage merely exacerbated it. Her hair, which she grew long to cover the sins of her neck, was so luxuriant and so dark her face looked sickly in its frame. Her mouth, which was her mother's mouth to the last flute, was naturally, even indecently, red, but taming its color with a pale lipstick merely made her eyes look vaster and more vulnerable than ever. It wasn't that the sum of her features was unattractive. She'd had more than her share of men at her feet. No, the trouble was she didn't look the way she felt. It was a sweet face, and she wasn't sweet, didn't want to be sweet, or thought of as sweet. Perhaps the powerful feelings that had touched her in the last few hours, seeing the blood, seeing the tombs, would make their mark in time. She hoped so. The memory of them moved in her still, and she was richer for them, however painful they'd been. Still naked, she wandered back into the bedroom. As she'd hoped, the celebrants next door had quieted down. The music was no longer rock and roll, but something smoochy. She sat on the edge of the bed and ran her palms back and forth over her breasts, enjoying their smoothness. Her breath had taken on the slow rhythm of the music through the wall, music for dancing groin to groin, mouth to mouth. She lay back on the bed,
her right hand sliding down her body. She could smell several months accrual of cigarette smoke in the coverlet she lay on. It made the room seem almost a public place with its nightly comings and goings. The thought of her nakedness in such a room and the smell of her skin's cleanliness on this stale bed was acutely arousing. She eased her first and middle fingers into her cunt, raising her hips a little to meet the exploration. This was a joy she offered herself all too seldom. Her Catholic upbringing had put guilt between her instinct and her fingertips. But tonight she was a different woman. She found the gasping places quickly, putting her feet on the edge of the bed and spreading her legs wide to give both hands a chance to play. It wasn't Boone she pictured as the first waves of goose flesh came. Dead men were bad lovers. Better she forget him. His face had been pretty, but she'd never kiss it again. His cock had been pretty, too, but she'd never stroke it or have it in her again. All she had was herself and pleasure for pleasure's sake. That was what she pictured now, the very act she was performing. A clean body naked on a stale bed. A woman in a strange room, enjoying her own strange self. The rhythm of the music no longer moved her. She had her own rhythm, rising and falling, each time climbing higher. There was no peak, just height after height, till she was running with sweat and gorged on sensation. She lay still for several minutes, then, knowing sleep was quickly overtaking her and that she could scarcely pass the night in her present position, she threw off all the covers but a single sheet, put her head on the pillow, and fell into the space behind her closed eyes. 2. The sweat on her body cooled beneath the thin sheet. In sleep, she was at Midian's necropolis, the wind coming to meet her down its avenues from all directions at once, north, south, east, and west, chilling her as it whipped her hair above her head and ran up inside her blouse. The wind was not invisible. It had a texture, as though it carried a weight of dust, the motes steadily gumming up her eyes and sealing her nose, finding its way into her underwear and up into her body by those roots, too. It was only as the dust blinded her completely that she realized what it was. The remains of the dead, the ancient dead, blown on contrary winds from pyramids and mausoleums, from vaults and dolmen, charnel houses and crematoria. Coffin dust and human ash and bone pounded to bits, all blown to Midian and catching her at the crossroads. She felt the dead inside her, behind her lids, in her throat, carried up toward her womb. And despite the chill and the fury of the four storms, she had no fear of them, nor desire to expel them. They sought her warmth and her womanliness. She would not reject them. "Where's Boone?" she asked in her dream, assuming the dead would know. He was one of their number, after all. She knew he was not far from her, but the wind was getting stronger, buffeting her from all directions, howling around her head. "Boone," she said again. "I want Boone. Bring him to me." The wind heard her. Its howling grew louder. But somebody else was nearby, distracting her from hearing its reply. "He's dead, Laurie," the voice said. She tried to ignore the idiot voice and concentrate on interpreting the wind, but she'd lost her place in the conversation and had to begin again. "It's Boone I want," she said. "Bring me—" "No," again that damn voice. She tried a third time, but the violence of the wind had become another violence. She was being shaken. "Laurie, wake up!" She clung to sleep, to the dream of wind. It might yet tell her what she needed to know if she could resist the assault of consciousness a moment longer. "Boone," she called again, but the winds were receding from her and taking the dead with them. She felt the itch of their exit from her veins and senses. What knowledge they had to impart was going with them. She was powerless to hold them. "Laurie!" Gone now, all of them gone. Carried away on the storm. She had no choice but to open her eyes, knowing they would find Cheryl, mere flesh and blood, sitting at the end of the bed and smiling at her. "Nightmare?" she said.
"No, not really.
You were calling his name."
"I know."
"You should have come out with me," Cheryl said. "Get him out of your system."
"Maybe."
Cheryl was beaming. She clearly had news to tell.
"You met somebody?"
Lori guessed. Cheryl's smile became a grin. "Who'd have thought it?" she said. "Mother may have been right after all."
"That good?"
"That good.
Tell all."
"There's not much to tell. I just went out to find a bar and I met this great guy. Who'd have thought it?" she said again. "In the middle of the damn prairies, love comes looking for me." She could barely contain her enthusiasm as she gave Lori a complete account of the night's romance. The man's name was Curtis, a banker, born in Vancouver, divorced, and recently moved to Edmonton. They were perfect complementaries, she said. Star signs, tastes in food and drink, family background. And better still, though they'd talked for hours, he'd not once tried to persuade her out of her underwear. He was a gentleman, articulate, intelligent, and yearning for the sophisticated life of the West Coast, to which he'd intimated he'd return if he could find the right companion. Maybe she was it. "I'm going to see him again tomorrow night," Cheryl said. "Maybe even stay over a few weeks if things go well."
"They will," Lori replied. "You deserve some good times."
"Are you going back to Calgary tomorrow?" Cheryl asked. "Yes," was the reply her mind was readying. But the dream was there before her, answering quite differently.
"I think I'll go back to Midian first," it said. "I want to see the place one more time."
Cheryl pulled face. "Please don't ask me to go," she said. "I'm not up for another visit."
"No problem,"
Lori replied. "I'm happy to go alone." Chapter 10 Sun and Shade. The sky was cloudless over Midian, the air effervescent. All the fretfulness she'd felt during her first visit here had disappeared. Though this was still the town where Boone had died, she could not hate it for that. Rather the reverse. She and it were allies, both marked by the man's passing. It was not the town itself she'd come to visit, however. It was the graveyard, and it did not disappoint her. The sun gleamed on the mausoleums, the sharp shadows flattering their elaborate decor. Even the grass that sprouted between the tombs was a more brilliant green today. There was no wind from any quarter, no breath of the dream storms bringing the dead. Within the high walls there was an extraordinary stillness, as if the outside world no longer existed. Here was a place sacred to the dead, who were not the living ceased, but almost